Hey everybody, welcome to the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick and I'm here with Pastors Bob Thune and Dusty White of Cormdale Church. And every Wednesday we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today we're sitting here again with Dr. James K. Smith and we're talking about how to take a liturgical audit.
Of your life.
Of your life.
So what is a liturgical audit? Well, so this is what we're going to do right now. I'm going to do my 2-minute summary of Dr. Smith's work.
Wow.
With him sitting here to see if I do a fair job, and then let him take it forward on, okay, so what do we do with this? So the quick summary would be, we are lovers, every one of us. This is the insight of St. Augustine, is that what drives us most foundationally is what we want, what we desire, what we long for, what we love. And therefore, our lives are always pointed in some direction. We're oriented towards some vision of the good life. And the challenge for us is that there are rival visions of the good life all around us, in our families, in our culture, among our friends. And those rival visions of the good life are always trying to conscript us and pull us away from living for God and His kingdom. And maybe the most important work you've done, Jamie, is just to connect the reality of habits and practices as the way that our loves get formed and shaped. So love is a more, what would you call it? I was going to say primitive, but that's not the right word. It's a deeper part of us than just thought. It's not like we think our way into new loves, but we sort of act our way. We habituate our way into new loves. Mm. So one of the things that you've talked a lot about as you've been here with us is this idea of taking a liturgical audit, meaning stepping back and asking, what are the habits and practices that I'm participating in without maybe thinking about it? And what are those practices doing? What are they shaping me in? And then how might I ask, okay, are there other practices or different sets of practices that might habituate me into a different way of being and living in the world? That was a very quick summary. Did I do
fantastic.
A decently
fantastic.
Fair job?
That's great. I'm not sure why I was here this weekend. That was great.
Wow. Okay. So anyways, I'm curious in the questions that we've gotten a lot as you've taught is, okay, I'm convinced. Like, I don't think it takes a lot of convincing for people to say, as soon as you set this up of like, oh yeah, I do. I mean, you used advertising and marketing a lot as a way of helping us see, well, we look at advertisements. They're not giving you ideas. They're creating a narrative world and an image and a picture of the kind of person you think you want to be. And then they're just pulling you into that. That makes absolute sense. And people go, okay, I get it. When you talk about how do I step back and do a liturgical audit of my life? How do I step back and say, what are the practices that are shaping me? And how do I sort of start to take stock of them? So that's what I want to talk about with you. But you made the statement, you've made it a couple times this weekend, that there are practices or habits that seem very benign to us, but they're actually doing something to us. Can you talk a little more about how that works?
Yeah, and I think this is the first step of the liturgical audit is the kind of wake up call moment, it's about seeing anew what's been in front of you the whole time. And I mentioned to you earlier, David Foster Wallace, fantastic writer, in his Kenyon College commencement address, tells this wonderful little parable of these two young fish are swimming in the water and this older fish is swimming to meet them. And the older fish says, howdy boys, how's the water? And they kind of look at him puzzled and they swim by and they're like, what the heck is water, right? And the point is, these fish are mired in water and don't know it, right? They don't even see the environment that they swim in. And so the goal of kind of doing this liturgical audit of your life is trying to find the space and place and time to almost become a foreigner to your own existence, right? Like to try to step back and look at, maybe you do it and you say in a week, like you take a snapshot of a week and you say, what are the rituals and rhythms and routines that I or we give ourselves over to that aren't just something that I do, but are doing something to me? That's where they might not be as benign as you might think. And the trick is it's so hard because it's like those young fish in the water, right? It's so around you, you can't even, you don't even know that there's water. And I think this is where sometimes the communal element of doing this is other people can help us see our own immersion in ways that we can't see for ourselves. So,
okay. So in stepping back and sort of just beginning to take stock of that, are there particular things I should look for? So you said take a week
yes,
at a time.
Yeah.
And you've said specifically practice, but I think, okay, if I'm looking at my average day, okay, I got a bed, here's I make coffee, put my clothes on. You know,
yeah,
like,
right.
What are the specific places where I should devote attention?
Yes. That's a great question. You're getting really practical, and I'm a philosopher who doesn't do this. So this is really great. I mean, I would love to hear how you guys, because I mean, I know that you guys are doing this on the ground. So I would love to learn how you help people do this. I would say it's looking at what are the things that you do that you take for granted that you've never asked yourself why you do them. So, what would be, I mean, obviously people are working, and by the way, I think, so if you want to imagine your work life, do a liturgical audit of your office or your workspace or your factory and just say, well, like, what are the kind of rituals and rhythms, that I'm pulled through just by virtue of showing up to work every day? And what is the implicit and tacit sort of story that's carried in those rhythms and rituals? I mean, what we're trying to do is unearth and ask ourselves, is there a kind of covert, subconscious story about human flourishing that I'm absorbing in these practices that I didn't even realize was loaded into them? And not everything is a liturgy. Do you know what I mean? Like, not everything you do, but let's take an example. Let's put it this way. What are the things I do that are doing something to me? That is, what is formative? One example I got thinking about is, I think I talked about this in Desiring the Kingdom. Imagine the difference in how you are shaped if you are sitting by yourself in a car for 2 hours every day, listening to talk radio, as opposed to riding with a community through the neighborhoods on a bus in which you are prompted into conversation. So two very different ways of commuting. So let's take something very banal, right? What I'm suggesting is those are just not formatively neutral. They are both things that are doing something to you, and over time, they might be doing things to you on registers that you're not aware of. So that the little incubator of the lone pod of anger, that is that solitary commute listening to Rush Limbaugh. Look, that's you. You're absorbing a story in that experience. There's a story of kind of autonomy and independence and isolation and things like that. Now, I'm not saying that riding a bus is a magic experience of moral concern for the neighbor, but it is a very interesting way that you will, for example, you will just inhabit a slice of your city that you don't bump into if you're in your car by yourself on the freeway. It creates opportunities and occasions to like meet neighbors and run into neighbors. The one thing I find interesting about riding the bus too is your schedule has to conform to somebody else's schedule. So it's a little pushback on your autonomy and independence. So it's maybe that's an example that's mundane enough that you start seeing almost everything with new eyes in that sense.
There's really an interesting example of that exact thing. So one of our friends, who's a school teacher, told me, we started doing this daily liturgy podcast where it's, you know, 15 minutes of scripture reading and prayers. And so he said, I used to listen to the radio in my car on my commute to school, which is about a 10-minute commute. And it's early in the morning. You know, I said, be at school at 7. So he's getting up early and just like, it was either music or talk radio or news or NPR or whatever, but it was just radio, sort of background noise that got his day started. He said, as I started listening to the daily liturgy podcast, here's what I realized I'm doing. That 10 minutes of my day is being redeemed for something spiritually formative. And it actually changes how I feel at noon, because I feel like I started that day like trying to encounter God through his word through my ears rather than just taking in whatever was. And so he would say, it's actually changing how I sort of feel when I get to school. And he would say, I can't put my finger on why. Like, it's not like I'm reciting scripture verses in my head, but I just have a different, there's a different way that I'm present sure. in the classroom as a result of that small change of 10 minutes yeah. of my day.
It's just enough of a nudge that it kind of changes the posture by which you enter your day. I don't know if this is trivial, but another recent example I've been thinking about. So I run for exercise 3 or 4 days a week. And ever since I've started a few years ago, I've always worn earbuds and listened to music while I'm running. That's how I suckered myself into trying to learn to run. And it's interesting. I started having just more kind of worries and, yeah, I don't know. I started thinking about this. And then in a sort of providential way, I get a running newsletter from the New York Times. And 1 week, the article was on why you should be running without headphones. And it was about actually sort of finding space for silence and contemplation from the distraction. And there was a way in which, even though I run through the city, I was kind of insulating myself from the city. And by always having music on, in a way, my mind was being drawn to a particular soundtrack. And listen, I'm not going to run to Sandra McCracken's Psalms. I want that in my office, but I'm not going to, it's not a great run. I'm running to Taylor Swift, let's be honest. And so I've started, just in the last few weeks, I've started running without earbuds and without music. And it is very interesting at how I think I've been much more inclined to pray during that time. I've been much more inclined to introspection. I think it's given me just new convictions about, I think some of the most countercultural disciplines we can be doing today revolve around silence and pushing back on that. But that's a slightly different point, but
no good. So let's actually pivot to that, because we've said this liturgical audit begins with what are the things I'm doing that are forming me without maybe me knowing it. And now the question would be, okay, what can I put in their place? And so you're saying, well, silence itself can be a
silence
a ritual.
Intrigues me. And it's funny. Like I was at a church in Charlotte 2 weeks ago, and I hadn't really thought about that this much, but this church, silence was kind of like really built into their liturgical rhythm. And it got me thinking about if there is, you know, a very contextual ad hoc reality of the moment and place in which we find ourselves, it is the incessant chatter that comprises a world of social media. I mean, it's really, really incredible. Like I resent the fact that I cannot find a seat in an airport where there's not a TV playing. Like it's impossible to escape CNN, or even the hotel elevators have CNN playing on them. It's like you get in the taxi, CNN is playing in the back of the taxi. I'm like, so, and kids, I think, obviously experience this in very intense ways. It's this constant chatter and distraction that is an enemy of contemplation and introspection. Alan Jacobs has a fantastic essay on this in Comet magazine last summer on how much the chatter of social media worlds make it impossible to actually reach a place to confess, because you don't know enough about yourself. You've entertained yourself out of ever having to face your inner soul. So yeah, it would be interesting to think about where could we start building capacities of silence, which by the way isn't just a negative thing either, right? It's like it's learning to be. My wife has for 25 years has always said, just be, just like, you know, like you don't have to be on the couch with a book. You don't have to be watching. If you're sitting down, just be. And she's an absolute master of this. Like, yo, she'll just sit on the couch and she's just contemplating and I'm watching. I'm like trying to finish three things. And she's just like there, but she has a depth of soul and character that comes from that kind of investment. I think it would be incredible if the church started thinking about what could we do to help foster that kind of. And notice to your point, this is an intentionally countercultural, counterformative discipline that's responding to a particular contextual challenge that would pull us away from the good that God is calling us to. Now, there's all kinds of ways to think about that, and it's why I think the historic disciplines of the church's worship actually have a lot of reservoir and resources to help us be formed, reformed, and transformed. But it's good to think about what are maybe some particular spiritual disciplines that in this moment and in our context might be germane. And I bet there, by the way, I bet there are class and geographical and even kind of racial realities that make that more important in some contexts than others. You know what I mean?
So I think that, like, we could end the podcast there and just say, okay, you've given us enough to just sort of step back and start doing the work of liturgical audit. It's interesting to ask the, I don't want to make this a specific application of that, but it's interesting to ask the question of what I think is the present reality for everyone in our church that no one quite, that feels like we don't quite know what to do with, is the ubiquity of technology, even in families, especially because you have kids with, they have to have an iPad for school. And so, like, we, one of the liturgies we notice in our family is we'll all be home at night and everybody's on a screen. We're sitting in the same room looking down at a screen. And so we started realizing, like, I don't think this is forming us in the right kinds of ways, but I'm intrigued at, in a culture where it seems like for me, I'm in the midst of a conversation with my kid's school because I feel like you're actually making it harder for me as a parent to have any sort of margin and space because you're forcing my kids that they got to do all their homework on a device. They got to have a device to communicate with their teachers. Everything flows through the network. And it's just intriguing to me to ask, how is that forming us and shaping us? And what are reasonable sets of practice there? And I know you've felt this with your family as well, Dusty, of just like, Is this an okay thing for Chris? Because it feels like beat your Luddite sometimes if you say, like, well, there needs to be boundaries around this. I don't think that's true. I think we have to set boundaries around it. But it's just it feels so new. It feels like such a new problem. And so I'm curious if you have reflections, Dusty or Jamie, on like how are these things? How should we be approaching the liturgy of our devices, whether it's smartphone or just the ubiquity of media and of input?
So it's intriguing to me that, because I agree with you, I don't think it's a matter of being anti-technology or Luddite, but it is about intentionality, right? And so every January, I spend time in the Bay Area in San Francisco with entrepreneurs and venture capitalists doing working with Praxis Labs. And what has been fascinating for me to watch over the last several years is the increasing use of flip phones by people who work in tech in the Bay Area. Why? Because they know the formative power.
They're building it.
They're building it, exactly.
Yeah.
And they're not subjecting themselves to it. The same way that, like, while everybody's holding out technology as this panacea for education, look, the rich and powerful are not sending their kids to schools where everybody gets an iPad, right? Harvard doesn't think massive online open content courses is the future of education. So, it's very intriguing to see that the people who make it know its formative power. I think intentionality about this is good. I just have to make a huge plug for Andy Crouch's new book called The Tech Wise Family, which is to me just the definitive take on this. And
not
it is
surprising,
so
he's
intensely
such a thoughtful guy.
Practical and like my stuff. And I literally wish I had the book 10 years ago when our kids were teenagers, because like you say, we're just old enough that we did not grow up in this environment. So we don't even know, I don't even really know the world that they are struggling with. So to know how to parent them, and TechWise Family opens with this like little manifesto of here's sort of 10 principles Andy would be the best person to articulate that. But it's really a how-to manual for how to be intentional about this without being reactionary, without being anti-technology, without being just sort of silly about it. And I think it's a really gift to the church.
That is I think what you're saying there too is something that we stop short of. So I think what we want to say is, well, don't let your device form you. But we don't know how to do it in a way. I don't think Christian parents know how to do it in a way that is just anti-tech. So then what would I do?
Yeah.
So even to vamp off of, you know, the whole work of you are what you love, to just put the cookies on the bottom shelf, maybe you could disagree with this if I'm being a heretic, but Basically, if I'm going to say no to something, I have to say yes to something, right? So I think where we get stuck even in the tech conversation is, well, what would I be saying yes to? I mean, the device is right there. Mm. So I would at least be able to do something. Mm-hmm. But to not do anything just feels crazy. So like even with your earbud example, you're going to say, well, I'm just going to take them out. But I'm actually saying yes to being reflective.
Yeah.
Contemplative.
Right.
That's the way I think about it.
Part of it is opening yourself up to a new possibility, but then coming to it with a new intentionality about that. Part of Andy's argument in the book is that, it's not just taking something out of your life. It's now positively, like there's a beautiful conversation saying, in our household, we are going to commit to being cultural creators. We're going to make stuff at night together. We're not just going to consume stuff individually in the same room. I think it's a really important conversation.
Well, I think you're saying things that, in a sense, all of us intuitively know, right? We know that the things we do have formative power. We're kind of afraid to name it sometimes. Mm. And we're kind of afraid to say, gosh, the repeated patterns that I have in my life are probably shaping me. And so just the idea of a liturgical audit, the idea of the freedom to step back and say, what are they? And the freedom to do that in community, because I think that it is crucial. So as you're listening, I would just invite, if you're married, a conversation with your spouse. If you have roommates, a conversation with your roommates. And if you're in a gospel community, maybe this is a great conversation with a gospel community of just, what are the liturgies, the existent practices in my life that are shaping me, and how can I develop the depth perception to step back and see what they are and begin to, as you say, naming them in a sense has its own power, because once I'm aware of them, I'll give an example from my own world. My kids play baseball. I'm the PA announcer at the baseball stadium.
Awesome.
So we do the national anthem every time. And it's changed. I've realized out of some of the stuff that you talked about in the liturgy of the stadium and desiring the kingdom and the sort of power of nationalism, I've realized like I've actually stopped placing my hand over my heart during the national anthem, because I'm just like, I don't know why I do that. Like, I do that because someone told
me
that was what I should do.
You.
I mean, I don't take off my hat. I'll stand because I'm like, I still want to honor this moment, but I want to like be self-aware of the fact that I do this whole thing that I do with my body. I don't know why, because someone told me when we do the anthem, this is what we do. I'm like, well, I don't do that when I walk into church. I don't, you know? And so for me, it's just allowed me to be aware of something that I feel like, I wasn't aware of that in the same way. And that's part of the win for me, is just seeing, oh gosh, I need to see that and be able to recognize how is it forming me, and how do I think about as a disciple of Jesus about this moment?
Yeah, and that's a great example. And it also speaks to the point about saying yes to something. So I think of kids in public schools, I think still often mm-hmm. say the Pledge yeah. of Allegiance at the beginning of the day. Is that right? Therefore, I think it's all the more important that they are invited to say the creed when they are gathered as the people of God. And because I feel like if you say both of those things, you're gonna feel the tension between the two. And that's good, you know?
Well, that's going to do it for this week's conversation. Please visit jamesksmith.com for more information on his resources and what he's doing. He's got a new book, Awaiting the King, coming out this fall. And we hope that you join us next week for another Wednesday conversation.